The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Cornell University or its employees.
Welcome to another episode of the Inclusive Excellence Podcast. Today, we are speaking with Antti Awapour, Assistant Ombuds in the Cornell University Ombuds Office. We talk with Antti about what the Ombuds Office does and about her work as an attorney and mediator in the conflict resolution field. My name is Erin Temper-Chase.
My name is Toral Patel.
And you are listening to the Inclusive Excellence Podcast.
Welcome, Antti. We're so excited to have you joining us today. So as we get started, can you please introduce yourself, what pronouns you use, and your role here at Cornell?
Hello, my name is Antti Awapour. My pronouns are she, her. And I'm an assistant ombuds at Cornell University Office of the Ombuds. And I joined the office in 2023 as assistant ombuds. I joined Bruce Lunstein, who is the university ombuds, and Linda Falkson, who is the director of the office. And I worked in the field before that. I worked at the United Nations Funds and Programs, where I served five of the UN organizations, including UNICEF and UNDP. I also served the University of Maryland Law School at the Center for Dispute Resolution as a staff attorney and mediator.
Wow. So yeah. You have a long history in this field. That's very interesting. Now, I can imagine some of our listeners might be wondering, wait, what does ombuds even mean? So can you just say a little bit more about what the ombuds office actually is, what they do, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. So the ombuds office at Cornell has been on campus for over 50 years. Actually, we are one of the very first ombuds offices across the nation in higher education. We serve faculty, student, and staff in anything that is Cornell related. In general, ombuds offices are about informal dispute resolution in organizations. So we do follow certain principles that are the principles of International Ombuds Association, which are four. One is that we are a confidential office, meaning that we do not share anything that's shared with us with anyone, except for if we have the permission from that person who comes to us, with narrow exceptions also if there is an imminent risk of serious harm or if there is any requirement by law, such as a subpoena by court. We are also an independent office, meaning that we do get our budget from the president's office, but we do not have any reporting duty in a hierarchical organizational manner. In addition, we are an impartial office, meaning that we do not take sides. We are third-party neutrals. We do not provide any advocacy services. Finally, we are also informal, which I think it's a huge advantage of the ombuds office because we do have a lot of flexibility on how we want to kind of conduct the sessions with our visitors and how we want to kind of navigate through different options. And informality actually gives us a lot of freedom in terms of, you know, serving the people who come to us.
That's great. And as you mentioned, that your office serves all three of our constituency groups, right? Students, faculty, and staff, which I think is phenomenal. And so how can individuals reach out to you?
So we usually have, you know, someone calls us by phone or emails us, and they can stay anonymous if they wish to. So they don't even have to share their names or any, you know, specific information. Of course, the more sometimes that's shared, it's easier for us to also support and give, like, provide information. But they don't have to. So someone, let's say, call us or email us, and then we decide that we can meet in person, we can meet via phone or via video call. So we provide all three sorts of meetings. And once we meet, actually, it's a very voluntary, informal meeting. We are happy to provide all the information. And let's say in the end of our intro, someone says, okay, thank you for the intro, but I'm not interested in sharing anything. That's perfectly fine. So we do encourage everyone to come to us when they're in doubt.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's good to hear. It's not like you have to fully commit,
You
know, to explore whether you might be a good resource for them or not.
Absolutely.
That's great. Like I commented earlier, you've been in this field for quite a while. I'm glad you're here now. Very glad that Cornell is getting the benefit of you since June. But I'd love to hear more about your professional journey up until you came to Cornell and why you became interested in the conflict resolution field.
Sure. So I was an attorney. Initially, I started off as an attorney in the Middle East. I was working mostly in trade matters, in international commercial aspects of cases and negotiations, as well as intellectual property. So I was what, you know, they call a very fierce attorney. Mm-hmm. I was very all about, like, you know, taking the most aggressive approach because I thought genuinely that's the best way of serving my clients. I thought, in my opinion, advocacy was all about, you know, fighting for people and making sure that you get as much as you can. Mm-hmm. You know, as they informally say, burn them to the ground. And I looked at the looked at the other party really as an adversary. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I saw that I'm doing everything I can to the best of my ability. I'm trying really hard and I'm getting a result that seems to be really a good result. It's winning in the traditional sense. Mm-hmm. And then my client wasn't happy. The other party wasn't happy. We didn't have any happy parties, actually. We just had one person who was angry and one who was less angry, the one who perhaps won the financial aspect of the case. So I talked to a lot of different colleagues and they said, yeah, we feel the same way. Clients are never happy. That's the nature of the work. Then I started becoming very interested in interdisciplinary studies, including, you know, economic analysis of the rules of law and judicial efficiency. The more I learned about it, the more I realized that we do not have a very efficient judicial system. Taking people to court actually will never end up in a win-win process. They will never give parties what they really want. If you look at different court systems, nobody really comes out of it happy. Yeah. So later on, I was introduced to the field of what we call alternative dispute resolution, or ADR. Now they also call it appropriate dispute resolution, which includes mediation, negotiation, and arbitration. Arbitration is more on the formal side. Later on, I started again doing more mediations. And when I started doing mediations, I realized that, oh, actually, parties do, you know, get what they want. Parties are happy. And not only they are happy, they are also equipped with tools to build a future relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, so they would go back again to their trade matter, to their family matter, and they still would be friendly because they chose the compromise, not that someone's dictating that to them.
You know, I love listening to your background, how it translates to your current position. And so you mentioned a little bit ago that the Ombuds Office also is really involved heavily in conflict resolution. Can you go into a little bit more detail? And then also, we've heard that the Ombuds Office used to be called the Ombudsman's Office. And talk a little bit about the name change and when that happened and why.
Absolutely. So in terms of the name, Ombudsman is an Scandinavian term. So it's not gendered in the original language, according to a lot of experts. However, because in English, you know, we use it, you know, when it sounds like gendered, International Ombudsman Association changed their names to Ombuds Association, and a lot of different offices, including Cornell, also changed. So we had to reprint a lot of promotional materials and change a lot of our names in different places from Ombudsman to Ombuds. But that was the philosophy behind it.
Interesting.
Yeah, in terms of how we engage in conflict resolution, what we do is that we provide any visitor who comes to us with a range of options. We are telling them what you have, from the most informal to the most formal option that they have. Mm. You know, it's like fight and flight, right? From doing nothing to doing absolutely anything and everything you can to the most formal way possible. But these are not the only solutions out there. These are usually the natural response that we have to a conflict, that we want to leave the room or we want to stay and fight. Mm-hmm. But since we are in control of, you know, how we want to react to a conflict, there are other options as well, which does include facilitated conversation, which we provide at the Ombuds Office at Cornell, mediation that different offices within Cornell, including the Scheinman Institute, also offers that. And a range of different conflict coaching or assisting parties in kind of navigating through different options and deciding what is the most efficient approach when they're dealing with an issue. And this issue can be as small as, oh, I'm just uncomfortable when I go to an awkward situation with my colleagues, to I'm being terminated and I need support in that sense. So we do cover a very wide range of issues.
That's really interesting, because I hear you when you say about how people could be in, there's like a big spectrum of where somebody might be at in terms of their own comfort. around this, and some of them might need that. I like hearing how you do coaching, because I could totally see how people might need coaching. And I would even imagine that sometimes the level of coaching somebody might need might depend on who the other person is that they're engaging with, right? You may be very comfortable with conflict resolution at home with your kids, with your partner, but to have to do it with your supervisor, right, or a coworker, it just takes on a whole other level of concerns and complexities. So it really is helpful to know that people can seek you out for that type of support.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm sitting here just thinking about, again, your history, your professional journey, all the different arenas that you've worked in, different settings, different countries even. And, you know, you probably have dealt with so many different types of people and so many different types of conflicts. What's been particularly interesting for you working in conflict mediation in particular?
So I think the best part of working in this field is that I see how productive it is. I see that how empowered parties are and how they take the skill set that we are teaching them with them. Mm-hmm. There is also an aspect of conflict prevention that's never measurable, because how can you measure that someone who would have gotten into another conflict avoided it by learning this skill set? So that's really what I like a lot about what I do. In addition, this whole notion of judicial efficiency is not something that's, you know, limited to the United States or any other specific country or region. There is an international kind of consensus on the fact that we do need informal dispute resolutions, even in international trade disputes. Relatively recent, in 2019, there was a convention by the United Nations that was provided to the world, which was the Singapore Convention, or as it's formally known, the United Nations Convention on International Settlement Agreement resulting from mediation. A lot of people were skeptical about it, and they were like, there are so many different legal regimes. It's so different across the board. And how are we going to have one way of approaching disputes if there is a mediation in one country? So basically, this is saying that if you have a mediation agreement in one country, you can take it to another country and enforce it like a court order. So there was a lot of questions about if that's going to ever happen. I actually wrote about this topic in 2019. And even then, I remember a lot of people were like, yes, wishful thinking. We appreciate the enthusiasm. But we see that, in relatively short period of time, 56 countries have joined. And if you look at the list of countries, it's very interesting. Countries that you would have thought, oh, they are really, really different in terms of the legal system. So I feel like the legal community at an international level has come to that conclusion. So that's on more the legalistic approach that I see from different countries. On the other hand, if I want to tell you about individuals, individual mediators I've worked with, let's say in Brazil, in France, in different countries I've worked, I am in touch with a lot of international mediators. And I see that some people do it really differently, and parties speak different languages. They come from different cultures, different backgrounds. They communicate differently. But if you look at really what they want and what their goals and interests are, I see more similarities than the differences. And that has always been the interesting part to me as an mediator or as a conflict resolution expert, because, you know, there is this Persian poem that is from Rumi, my favorite actually poet, who says, four people wanted to get something, buy something with the same amount of money they had, and they couldn't agree on what they want to buy. One would say, I want, buy the same thing in a different language. They wanted grapes, right? And the other one would say grape in another language. Four of them would just ask grape, but in four different languages, and they didn't understand each other. And the wise man comes and says, okay, let me see what you guys are saying. And they realized that they all wanted the same thing. They were technically in agreement, but they didn't see it. They didn't know it. So from what it appears to be really internationally diverse community, I think we still, if we dig really deep, we'll see a lot of similarities. So that's the best part for me.
For sure.
Yeah, that really speaks to me, this idea that though we all have different languages, different cultures, you know, things that we celebrate different holidays, but yet, you know, at the very basic level, we could have a lot of similarities. That idea really speaks to me. And as you mentioned, that at the same time, that ideal world is also wishful thinking, right? But if done correctly, I love the words they use earlier, that this could be something that could be very productive and empowering to a lot of people. And so what do you think gets in the way?
Yeah, I feel like sometimes, let's say I have a dispute with Erin, God forbid. And
don't cross me.
I would never dare. I feel like, oh, I know what Erin wants. You know, this is one of the most common issues that we make. It's one of the most cognitive mistakes that we are making, that we are trying to read people's minds. And we think that, oh, I know what they want. I know what they will agree to. I know what they will disagree with. So we go to a conversation or dialogue with this idea of that this is the outcome I want. This is what I know they're going to give me. Mm-hmm. And that kind of closes the door for openness, to listen, to really see what the other party is talking about or what they want. It's impossible to really know or have the full picture because we don't have all the information. We just know half of the information at the best case scenario, right? Just one side, which is our side, which sometimes we even don't know because we haven't really explored all the details. So getting that information, processing it, not really being so focused and fixated on one solution or the other. I think that's kind of the best way to approach, and that's the main issue that I see.
So basically, if I'm understanding you right, Ati, it's when we enter some of these disputes, disagreements, whatever you want to call it, we might already have in our own mind what we are assuming the other person is going to bring to the table. You know, we're assuming what they want. And we might be fixated ourselves on thinking that there is only one solution. And you know, what I want in this situation. And I never thought about, you know, some people might think, well, that means you're coming prepared. You're coming ready, yeah. You know what I mean? But really, what you're suggesting is that it may actually be less about preparation and more about closing yourself off to exploring the possibilities. Am I getting that right?
Totally. And there is a flip side to that as well. I don't know if you have ever had a dispute with someone and they said, and you said, like, I didn't know you wanted that. And they said, you never ask. I'm like, I thought you should have known better.
Yeah.
You know, that's another cognitive error. Some of the most common cognitive errors are mind reading and the expectation of mind reading.
Yeah.
So not being open, not really explaining your position, not really asking the right questions or actively listening. Mm-hmm. I know you had an episode on the difference between dialogue and discussion and debate. And yeah, that's really about dialogue building, you know, just listening without expectation.
Okay, so let's go a little further with that then. What would successful informal conflict resolution look like? Like how can people actually do that in theory?
Yeah, I feel like I said, that the first step would be being open and actively listening.
Mm-hmm.
So we start a conversation and, you know, we, as they say, first seek to understand before being understood. And I feel like if we go into those meetings, in those conversations, by trying to first really trying to see what the goals are, what the benefits of the other party is, and meeting them where they are, not where we want them to be. And there's a big difference in, okay, I want this person to be at this point in terms of agreement with me. And we just think that being very solid, very rigid about this is my position, come meet me there, is very good way of negotiating, you know, like, or asking more, and then they will agree to less. So that will look like a compromise while you're getting everything. And that's like considered a successful negotiation. I get that from a traditional kind of sense. Yes, it is a very successful negotiation. But there are other ways to do it because there are more kind of creative ways to resolve a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is this very famous example that is about an orange in conflict resolution, that there were two kids and they were fighting over one orange. So the resources are limited, right? In conflict, it's mostly about resources. Mm-hmm. We have limited resources and sometimes unlimited needs. or at least the needs that we think are bigger than the resources. And that becomes the source of a lot of fights. So these two kids had like one orange. They each wanted the orange. And the mom comes and sees that they're yelling and screaming and shouting and mm-hmm. says, okay, I'm a good mom. I'm just going to cut it in half and gives each of them like a half because that seems like the best solution available. And then the mom goes after a while and sees one of the kids is actually eating the orange and peeling and throwing out the rest. And then the other one is actually just using the zest for a lemon cake and is not going to use the orange fruit like and is not going to eat it. So had the right question been asked, both of these kids would have 100% of what they want. And if you initially go back like, wait, how? There is one orange, they want two oranges. And this is what we call expanding the pie, which means you're expanding the value of the resources that are available, which comes, you know, as part of the creative solutions. So when parties really seriously listen to one another and explore more, try instead of like being, okay, I'm at point A, meet me here. Let's see what other points are available. And sometimes you would be surprised that, oh, okay, we can actually build this future relationship that I will benefit from it long term. So if you look at the grand scheme of, you know, the relationship, you will see that ultimately both of them are getting way more than they initially expected to get.
I love that example.
Yeah. I'm really thinking about that. That's
I know.
Really neat.
That is very deep. And I love this idea of expanding the pie and that, you know, I actually thought cutting it in half, what a great solution, right? When you first explained it. And then as you continued the example, I was like, wow, what a great concept is the thinking outside of what's normally possible. And, you know, that you can actually expand the pie and both of the children could get 100% of what they actually wanted from that orange. Yeah. And I love comparing that to the other example, which is asking for something a lot more than what you actually want out of the solution. So that way, when you leave, you feel satisfied, right? And that is a great negotiation tactic, but but to your point, that isn't the only one. And so I love thinking about it and flipping this whole concept.
And all it took was asking just one more question.
Exactly.
You know, why? What is it about the orange?
Yeah, what do you want?
Yeah, what is it that you want from that orange? And just adding that simple question to get them to talk more could make a huge difference in the outcome.
Yeah, just that little bit more of that dialogue that we mentioned.
Yeah, yeah, and meeting them, you know, where they are actually. And, and instead of saying, oh, this is where I am, this is where you are, there's no way we're going to agree. Just expanding, exploring different options. And you would be surprised how parties do have a lot of creative solutions. Because, you know, if a third party is making a decision, let's say it's a judge, arbitrator, investigator, whoever that may be, who is trying to go formally about a situation and saying, oh, there was a wrongdoing or there was this and that, there is no way that that person will have more information and the actual parties who were dealing with it. So I would like to say that like a lot of lawyers, mediators can be method experts. So we provide the method. But in terms of what needs to be done or said, I think the parties who are dealing with that issue day to day are in the best possible position to decide that.
Right.
Yeah. And that's something great to actually think about, right? That the conflict resolution can be done by the two individuals themselves. And I would actually also love to explore, to your point exactly, is like, when is it appropriate to bring in the third party? Or in this case, let's talk about the ombuds office, right? And so within our work setting, when would it be appropriate for whether faculty, staff, or student to come seek the advice or the expertise of the ombuds office? Versus kind of talking this through themselves?
In general, the sooner the better. You know, it's easier to address an issue when it's not very severe or there are not multiple issues. It's always, you know, a less complex issue is easier to resolve. And once you resolve that one issue, there is a very high possibility that these two people will work together for the next issue. So there may never be even a next issue. And a lot of visitors I hear, not just at Cornell in general, that they're like, oh, but my issue is not really that big of a deal. I shouldn't take anyone's time for this. And I say, it's like, when you see a leak in your bathroom, when do you call the plumber? When you see you have high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol, when do you go to the doctor? Do you expect like the doctor to think, oh my God, that was very petty. You just had a little bit of high blood cholesterol. Yeah. Go come back when you're having a heart attack. That's not how you approach your, you know, physical health or, you know, the tangible aspect of issues. And the intangible or, you know, the feelings about conflict and all that should not be any different, in my opinion. So the sooner, just come to us. And, you know, like it may also be that the case we prevent it altogether, so it never happens. So that's much easier fix.
I will share like a funny story that kind of speaks to me. It's like when my husband and I first got married and we used to have our fights like any marriage does, but we would hold on, right, and not actually talk about what the issue was. And so when we had the fight, it was a really big fight. To your point, you're bringing everything, right, that has happened since that incident, the initial incident, into it. And so the fight is a lot bigger than it needed to be. Over the years that we've been married, now we've learned that, like, if it's something that's really annoying me right now, we need to have it out right now. And now it's like we have these little discussions that are like 5 minutes and we're done. But whereas when we initially started, we couldn't navigate that. So it's funny because how some of exactly what you're saying, I could see that it was reflected in my personal life, too.
Yeah. And what happens is that when you do those like mini practices, you don't really have to start building a dialogue and see how can I have a conversation with this person? What is their personality type when there is a huge issue and everyone is in distress?
Right.
And you know how they say in army, the more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's also about conversations. If you have those little conversations when there is like a peaceful relationship still, it makes it easier than like, okay, now I have this huge deal of, you know, issues and I want to tackle all of them together. And you may also have had a lot of resentments towards that person because there were a lot of things that you haven't said and like you wanted to say. Your example was amazing. I think that 100% is applicable.
Well, and I think you run the risk if you don't address it early on, you run the risk of all that bottling up. And then it may suddenly come out over something that actually on the surface appears very minor.
Right.
But to your point, it's not just about that. It's about everything that led up to that. But you've allowed it to build up, you know. And I think that, you know, when you said earlier about how some people might feel like, well, it's not that big of a deal, or I need to just get over it, or, you know, I shouldn't be so sensitive. You know, there's a balance there, sure. You want to be balanced, but at the same time, you have to value yourself enough to know that, no, this isn't okay. And I do need to do something about it. And I need help in figuring out, you know, what to do about it.
Yeah, and the help is available, you know. There is an ombuds office, let's say, if there's a staff issue. There is an office. This is part of, you know, the whole package that you have at Cornell, right? So you have access to different offices that we also try to send visitors to. For example, faculty staff assistance program. I refer a lot of people there and I hear amazing results. So I think it's good to know at least what your resources are, and that helps also in decision making when you want to compromise, to what extent you want to compromise.
You know, I feel like most people want to just have, you know, a decent work situation. Most people, we have to spend so much of our time at work. Most of us just want to get along, right? Just want to get along with people, don't want to have any problems, that sort of thing. At the same time, as you said, there may be times when that's not going well and you really feel like you need to address it, but you don't know how. And I do think we have to be real about the fact that when there is also a power dynamic difference there, you know, that can make it even more challenging, whether it's because it's your supervisor or even if it's just a coworker, but maybe somebody who's been there longer than you've been there, right? And you still feel like you're the new one and that sort of thing. So I guess I'm just wondering, how can employees who are in that type of position where there is that power differential, you know, how can they approach trying to navigate this situation in a way that feels like they're, you know, that they're valuing themselves and not losing themselves in the process, but also respects the fact that, you know, there's some dynamics there that are hard to work with?
That's actually a very common issue. And in mediation, they say if there is a power imbalance to the level that we don't really think parties are freely engaging in the conversation, maybe that's not even the best option. So when I am dealing with a visitor who says, okay, I'm with this person who has been in the office longer than I have been or is in a higher position than I have been. So a lot of the issues about the communication of what you want is about how you communicate it, as opposed to what you're asking for. Some employees may say, oh, I feel like if I don't say anything now, it just means that I'm endorsing that position. That's not true. That's what we're just assuming. You can just digest the conversation, see what was told. It's a lot about phrasing, you know, how you're saying it, or which tools you're using. Let's say you want to talk immediately in a meeting, or you want to go think about it and then bring up the issue in a one-on-one. So that addresses some of the power imbalance. Some of the power imbalance is just our assumption. I have seen like someone who thinks, oh, by default, whoever is a professor is in a higher position of power. Maybe from an administrative standpoint, yes, but from a conflict resolution standpoint, not necessarily. You can still be equipped with ways to address a conflict in a way that balances some of the power imbalance. It is very hard to say we are 100% in balance because let's say even if we are colleagues at the same level, but someone articulates themselves better, someone is a better speaker, someone talks faster, or the other party may be just someone, you know, a different personality who needs more time to discuss a matter and thinks that the other person is more aggressive, there will be still some power imbalance. So we cannot avoid it. That's the bottom line. But we can address it in different ways. And sometimes you use a third party, right? So let's say you are dealing with a supervisor and you really think you cannot have that conversation. But there are different offices within campus. You can go, you know, to HR and ask for that help. You can go to a mentor and see how they can involve other ways or maybe solutions. Or let's say there is a Title IX question you have. You don't necessarily have to go to a person and say, oh, I think you're discriminating against me. You can first go and explore and see what options are available and then make a decision based on that. But again, it goes back to the degree of the power imbalance and how parties are prepared. Sometimes I've seen that someone who thinks there is no way I can talk to this person because of a resentment or because I just dislike them or because I just think they're too powerful. And then when we go through what we call like mock conversations, let's say I'm that person, how would you tell me? They say it and they're like, oh, actually, I could have talked to that person. I thought I can't. But now that I'm thinking about it and they go back, you know, and with that conflict coaching, with that preparation, they see at least they can achieve some of what they were asking for. It may never be perfect. We don't live, like you said, in a perfect ideal world, but we are moving towards, you know, making as much effort possible to that kind of informal resolution, to that peaceful resolution or the ideal kind of environment to work.
Ati, can you talk a little bit about what would happen in a situation where you're willing to have the conversation, but maybe the opposing party is not? Or you're willing to have the conversation respectfully, you're approaching it one particular way. As you mentioned, I think a lot of times it's the context, it's the how you approach versus the kind of the not necessarily the words that you say, but maybe you're approaching it, you know, a respectfully manner and they're not. They're still coming at it as more of a conflict versus the resolution. How do you as an individual deal with that? And is that a good time to also involve the Ombuds Office?
So the last question about the Ombuds Office, since we do not really provide any advocacy services, we may not be the best kind of to go and advocate for them, even though like we do support staff to find the right resources. Let's say there is a grievance procedure. We do have employee rep program, so we cannot go and talk for them, but there is an employee rep who can. So sometimes there are solutions like that. A third party comes in the middle and helps kind of the conversation. But in terms of what I would do as a person, yes, there is, you know, it takes two to really have that conversation. But the bottom line is that we do not have control over how someone else reacts to what we want, but we do then have the power over how we want to react. I always tell, you know, the visitors that I am not against an emotional response so long as you are in charge of your emotions, not that your emotions are in charge of you. So long as we know that, yes, this kind of person is not engaging in that conversation. So what happens then is that at least you know you have done your part. And then if you, let's say, go and follow a formal procedure, or if you go and involve a third party, or if you request a mediation with, I don't know, Scheinman Institute or any other community mediation that is available, then you know you have done your part, you have tried to approach them, and that kind of decision that comes from, you know, like that knowledge, that informed decision also is very empowering. The empowerment doesn't always look like, oh, we have, you know, everything I wanted, I got, like have a conversation, yes, I got it. Sometimes it's the form of, okay, now I know that there are little ways to move forward with this dialogue. How else can I approach this? Maybe I want now to send an email and share my perspective. Maybe I just want to say it in a meeting and see who else is kind of on board. Of course, if it's appropriate for the environment, there's no one way of approaching it. But yeah, I think just there is a, it is very empowering when we know that we are in control, we are in control of how we want to react. And, you know, there are a lot of options, but sometimes I say to visitors that like, oh, now I don't want to do anything. I say, it's different though, when you know all the options and you have tried to a level that you wanted to try. This doing nothing is different than doing nothing because I just don't even want to deal with it. It means you have dealt with it. Now you have all the information. Now you decide at this point in time, I want to put this issue in a box and deprioritize it, not to eliminate it. Just deprioritize it for right now because of my own sake. Mm-hmm. So it's always about what our goals are, how we want to get to our goals, what we want to achieve. And sometimes we see that those conversations are not necessarily, you know, part of what we need to achieve what we want, or it can be substituted with different kind of options. So it doesn't always have to be with parties who are on 100% of agreement. It can be also parties disagreeing, but understanding that, okay, I disagree with this colleague on this topic and I still carry on. I go to work and work with them. That's fine. Normalizing conflict, I think, is also an accomplishment.
I'm really finding all this really interesting to think about because, you know, I came into this conversation today assuming that we were going to primarily talk about, you know, how you focus on conflict mediation and resolution with another person in order to try to get to a particular solution and to a better place. But the more I hear you talk, it's more like it's almost just as important, if not more important, to enter into these situations not so much focused on the other person or even what the situation is with the other person, but more focused on yourself and how you are going to approach navigating both the immediate situation and also navigating moving forward, right? That whole idea of empowerment isn't always about I'm empowered now to go to that person and, you know, stand up for myself. Empowerment may look very different. It may be more of a coming away with a clear idea of what is actually most important to me and how can I achieve that? How can I get
exactly
to that point?
100%.
It's really, really interesting to think a bit more that way.
Yeah, and you see like in the more kind of direct conversations or confrontational kind of ways of approaching a dispute, you see sometimes people do get to talk to each other, do get to vent and say whatever they wanted to say. But are they in the end happy in the sense that, oh, this was the best resolution available? So the best resolution is not always the most kind of aggressive one or is not always the most confrontational one. And yes, that's a reality. Sometimes we have to deal with like people who have totally different types of personality. And yeah, there are solutions for that as well. And navigate through different styles of communication, conversations, and how to really see the message that someone is trying to send. Because a lot of times we are also getting the message wrong because of different styles of communication.
Right.
So kind of distinguishing these and seeing where we can meet someone. And sometimes, yeah, there may not be a solution or there may not be a solution right now. It doesn't mean that there never will be. It just maybe temporarily we have to stop looking at this.
Well, I also think that you're kind of reminding us that sometimes getting too focused on what the issue or the problem or the source of the disagreement is isn't very helpful because, like you said earlier, okay, so let's say you do resolve that, somebody admits they're wrong, whatever, people still don't come away that happy. They still don't come away feeling so good about it, and that's because you haven't actually addressed the relationship. You haven't necessarily addressed where do you go from here, you know, because you still have to work together, you still have to coexist. And so that idea of normalizing that there will be conflicts, there will be disagreements, and you're normalizing how to navigate those in a way that preserves the relationship and keeps the focus on that. It's so much more valuable than trying to just focus on solving the immediate problem that happens to be happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And especially to your point, Aaron, if at the end, both of you don't get to an agreement, right? Yeah. Like if there is no agreement, then maybe the how is the more important concept is so that you can continue to preserve that relationship. Because tomorrow, especially in a work setting, you're going to see them again. They're part of your team, right? And so I think the idea of hey, you and I will never agree on this, and that's okay, right? Because you and we were able to talk through it. Both of us were able to share our viewpoints, where we're coming from, and that somehow betters the relationship and allows you to continue that working relationship.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, like, is it always bad to have different opinions or even opposing opinions?
Shouldn't it be, right?
That's a huge advantage for a team.
Yeah, totally. Because if everyone agrees with everyone, where is the progress, right? You know, there is this example, like they say that someone came up with the idea of let's fly as human beings, and some people laughed and said, this is just insane. Why would we do that? It's very dangerous. It's very risky. And they were right in some sense. And then someone else said, yeah, but for how long are we not even going to try? And then they tried and tried, and some disagreed with that. And because of these opposing ideas, now we have airplanes and then we have the life jackets.
Right.
So having different or even opposing ideas is not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it even causes the flow of information and creates a, you know, larger dialogue. And from that, larger solutions come out, right? So we have these two different topics. How do we come to a resolution to coexist, as you said? How can we just accept that there are these differences? Yet, yes, we need that. Like, you know, you need cold weather and warm weather at the same time. Who can say which one is better? You know, sometimes even having opposing ideas helps, you know, diversify a team, diversify ideas, and some new ideas may emerge out of that.
Well, and like you said earlier, the irony of that good analogy you gave about planes and life jackets is that approaching that disagreement, that thinking, was also ended up resulting in something that would prevent further conflict, you know, by inventing life jackets, right? So like you said before, sometimes dealing with mediation in the moment is actually a form of conflict prevention later on of having something that could be greater than happened. I just wish there were conflict mediation for cats because, you know, back when I had cats, it would have been great to have, you know, if we could have both participated in some of these skills instead of feeling like the cat was always waging a silent war that I knew nothing about, you know. Too bad they couldn't have learned this, but yeah.
You know, dogs have owners, cats have staff, so there's a power imbalance there.
Good point. Well, this has been so, so enlightening. Thank you so much, Ati. It's been great talking to you. It's been great to learn more about the Ombuds Office and what they can do. And I'm glad I know now. If I'm ever in doubt, ever unsure, before I blow my top, I'm going to call you all and have you coach me through it. That sounds good.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Toral, Aaron, and Bert. I appreciate the opportunity, and when in doubt, please feel free to call us or email us, and we can start a conversation for sure.
Aaron, I knew going into this conversation that this meeting with Ati was going to be phenomenal, and I was not wrong.
Yeah, I agree. She just has such an interesting wealth of experience and knowledge, and you know, it was really, really neat to hear about how she started as an attorney and sort of that typical, or stereotypical maybe,
burn them to the ground.
Know, yeah, role of being aggressive, being all about winning. Mm-hmm. And I just so appreciated how that process sort of was enlightening for her and made her realize that it wasn't really helping.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, and it kind of made her realize actually everybody's not winning and everybody's not happy. And, you know, maybe there needs to be a different way to be helping people approach their problems.
Correct. Yeah, I think the idea that, you know, she talked about, like, it doesn't matter what party you are, mm-hmm. neither one is happy.
Yeah.
So there is no win-win, and if that's what the solution you're looking for. And at the end of it, like, neither party is actually equipped with bettering that relationship.
That's right.
Right?
That's
because
right.
you're just like, okay, we've solved one issue, but the actual key is how do you move past
yes.
and continue that relationship? That never gets resolved.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other thing she talked about that I really enjoyed is this fight or flight mentality, right? Like the idea that even in a resolution type of a conversation, those are kind of like the two reactions that people normally
yeah.
have, which is, yeah, I don't want to engage, right? I'm completely going to ignore that this was said or this happened,
mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to fight, you know, to death, basically,
yeah.
right? Like
yeah.
burn him, like as she mentioned, burn him to the ground.
Uh-huh.
And the idea that there's so much in the middle,
yeah,
right, that we don't ever explore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was really fascinating. She really talked about it with that example about the orange
mm-hmm.
and the two children, how, you know, the solution was just to cut it down in the center. Each mm-hmm. kid got half, when in reality, each kid could have gotten 100% of what they
wanted.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, a lot of what she emphasized today is, again, sort of getting out of that mindset that it's just about whatever the problem is that's
right.
occurring, and realizing it's actually more about the impact on the relationship.
Yeah.
And on you. You as a person and on your relationship, which is why people don't come out completely happy
right.
when you resolve the quote-unquote conflict, because actually you haven't actually resolved what was really the more upsetting part, which is that this conflict is getting in the way of our relationship.
Correct.
You know, and so we need to focus on how to preserve the relationship. Because guess what? There will be more conflicts.
Exactly.
This isn't going to be the only one.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Like that's the basic thing that we know is going to continue,
yeah.
is that you're going to have more conflicts
yeah.
in the future. And the idea that when you, I think it's almost looking at it like focusing on the what versus the how.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you focus on the how, that's when it leads to the productive relationships. It's the empowering individuals
mm-hmm.
to actually have conversations, come up with resolutions or not,
or
and
not.
And actually agree to disagree
yeah.
and yet still have a relationship at
yes.
the end of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And to that end, I mean, we had to talk about the very real issue of there being power imbalances.
Right.
And that often that's what gets in the way of somebody feeling like they can approach conflict resolution, mediation, is because of that power imbalance. But I liked how she expanded her thinking of the fact that there's always going to be a power imbalance. Even if you have two people that are quote-unquote completely equal in position or whatever, there's going to be other things that influence how they show up in that discussion or that relationship. So power looks many different ways. It's not just about title. You
yeah.
know, it works a lot of different ways. And so you can't avoid it. So therefore, that can't be the reason not to do it. Right? It's more that you have to recognize it, name it, and figure out how to navigate it.
Yeah. And I'm going to, you know, just kind of say, as we look at this from kind of the field that you and I are in, right,
mm-hmm.
in the DE&I space, where when we talk about conflict, it is like huge conflicts between people. It is, you know, some things that they've grown up impacts their belief systems
mm-hmm.
And who they are as individuals,
yeah.
right? And I think just having this conversation with that team makes me feel like even navigating those areas
mm-hmm.
that you could do that respectfully. And most of the time when we look at diversity, inclusion, equity issues, it is very much approached as a right or wrong
yeah.
mentality.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think this conversation shows us that you can actually approach this as a relationship building,
yes.
right? And then you can maybe approach it as, instead of the right or wrong mentality, the black and white mentality, you can approach anything with peace and love
mm-hmm.
and respect. And then what does that do to the relationship
right.
that you have? Though,
right.
you know, I truly wholeheartedly believe that even though we grow up differently with completely different belief systems, that there are people that I'm going to work with for the next however many years until I retire.
Yeah.
And I think we can kind of build a relationship through those differences.
Yeah.
And I think this is a way to do that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And even after you retire, you know,
right.
they're
going to
be
yes.
your neighbors.
Yes.
They're
going to
be in the next room at the senior citizen home, you know. There's
yes.
going to be all kinds of places. So, yeah, I completely agree. And there's a lot of food for thought that she gave us about how to manage these differences, particularly in today's times when there are a lot of differences out there. So really figuring out how to manage them and not lose sight of the people, not get so caught up in the issue and lose sight of the people.
Correct. And the idea that being caught up that way closes the door on so many possibilities, right?
Yes.
And I will further to say so many relationships that we could actually build with others.
Absolutely.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast is a production of the Department of Inclusion and Belonging in collaboration with the Cornell Broadcast Studio. Be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts and rate and submit a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find us and the show. For latest updates on diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging at Cornell, be sure to visit diversity.cornell.edu. My name is Toral Patel.
And my name is Erin Sembuchase. We would also like to thank our co-producer and sound engineer, Bert Odom Reed, as always, for making us sound amazing each and every episode.
Thanks, Bert.